big tech has snapped up an entire sector of the market.
Hey, friends. Healthcare is changing faster than ever, with billions in funding announced every single week.
Over 300 million worth of capital will be going back to our investors.
AI has entered the chat, and scientific discoveries are happening left, right, and center that are set to change the face of healthcare.
How do I deliver value tangibly and best allocate my resources in a way that isn't going to be cannibalized 2 months from now?
So, how do you keep up?
And the GP was a bit like, oh, I've never done this before, but I can work with it.
Introducing What the Health Wrapped, your fortnightly deep dive with some of the smartest minds in healthcare into the top headlines that you should know about. Building on What the Health, our killer community of 11,000, and our newsletter of 5 years. In partnership with 10 Mile, building bold ventures for better health and helping address the unmet needs in healthcare. We'll cut through the BS.
And I'm not sure how much it'll address primary healthcare as opposed to maybe adding another layer of preventative healthcare on top of primary.
And bring you the latest in health tech and innovation. ADCs are clearly a hot topic.
A lot of the ADCs use chemotherapy, and that's really the gap that Myrix was able to address.
AI and drug discovery. What are the implications? So join us for the latest news in healthcare, and let's have a yap. Joining me today are two incredible guests, Dr. Jackie Rebeck, co-founder of ThinkMD AI, previously Google and head of product at Heidi Health. Welcome, Jackie. And we're also joined by Dr. Prashant Rajan, an investor at Brandon Capital, Australian leading venture capital fund. Welcome, team. Now, please tell us what you've been up to this last little while. Jackie, I know you've been hard at work on the founding front. What's been keeping you busy?
So in the last couple of months, I tend to spend quite a lot of time outside of Australia because most of ThinkMD's operations is in really fragile healthcare settings. And so in the last couple of months, that's looked like spending time in Kenya, Rwanda, South Africa. Did a little bit of a stint at the Skoll conference in London, which is a big impact-oriented kind of community forum. And we've been building, we've been implementing, we've been operationalizing, we've been navigating Ebola breakouts, we've been navigating fuel crises in Kenya. It's been a full and robust couple of months.
That's a totally different world. And if you had to summarize what you guys are building in 1 to 2 sentences, how would you?
Yeah. So ThinkMD sets to solve the fact that the world is short maybe 15 million healthcare workers or doctors, and the doctor to patient ratio in really fragile healthcare settings is often like one doctor for every 10,000 patients. And so we build clinical intelligence tools that are offline capable and can be used by a frontline healthcare worker that does not have the same degree of training as a medical doctor to be able to form really high quality diagnoses or risk assessments for patients and ultimately deliver high quality standardized care in remote and rural regions.
So meaningful, bringing healthcare to those who really do need it the most. And Prashant, what's been keeping you busy lately?
Unfortunately, not as much travel to what sounds like some great countries in Africa. But I've been at Bio, which is one of the largest life sciences conferences. Just returned from that about 2 weeks ago. And since then, we've just had a flurry of activity from our portfolios and some great news, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. But also some things that we're still working on, interesting new technologies and great founders working on very challenging problems that we're quite excited about working with all these founders and helping them build those companies.
Awesome. And how was Bio this year? There seemed to be a giant Australian delegation
over
there.
Yeah, the Bio conference is great. Always a good Australian representation. And you know, this is now, it's no news to anybody that's been there, but coffee is obviously a major draw to the Australian booth. And every year they do a great job of having probably the best coffee at the booths and at Bio. So conference is great. You know, lots of interactions. Certainly there's been an uptick in partnering activity from the biopharma sector anyway. So I felt like there's renewed enthusiasm for a lot of companies, certainly compared to last year where a lot of the talk was all about near-tier winter and funding. So I think there's green shoots and optimism. So that's always good.
It's what we love to hear, about time. And especially when there's extra good coffee around, it makes it all the better.
You desperately need it when you're there.
Fueled by Australian coffee. All right, before we jump in, here's the wrap from the last fortnight. Real quick, Novartis agreed to acquire Myrix Bio in a deal worth up to US$1.5 billion, or 2.1 billion Australian. Proposed changes to the Australian tax R&D incentive has sparked major concern across the ecosystem and is still yet to be resolved. Chai Discovery announced a US$400 million Series C for AI drug discovery and development. AdvanCell just announced a closed, oversubscribed US$315 million Series D round. Everlab raised 65 million Aussie for preventative health and longevity to continue. Nico Healthcare, Daniel Eck from Spotify's new health venture raised 700 million USD for their new preventative health scans and solutions. And Anthropic has launched Claude for Healthcare and is recruiting ahead of global partnerships for global health, I believe. And there's plenty of other stories for us to dive into, but this is the quick summary and what we think is worth diving into today. Let's jump in. Let's kick things off with a massive win for the home crowd. It's not every day that we have a big acquisition in biotech, and it's kind of what a lot of the industry is waiting for. We've got a few more funds popping up, but exits are still few and far between over here. But Novartis has agreed to acquire UK-based Myrix Bio in a blockbuster deal worth up to US $1.5 billion, or Aussie $2.2 billion, not $2.1. But now, while Myrix is technically headquartered in London and was a spin-out from over there, it's a huge win for the ecosystem because Brandon Capital was one of the joint founding seed investors back in 2019, I believe, and backing the original spin-out science and the company all the way through to exit in just 7 years. Even more remarkable, Novartis is paying around $1.1 billion upfront in cash with US $400 million in milestones, which for a company that's preclinical is pretty impressive. Brandon is expected to get a nice return from this, and it will see some funds flow back to the Australian ecosystem and a whole heap of LPs, which hopefully provides a little bit of validation. And it's one of the biggest venture capital returns, I believe, Australia has seen in biotech today. Is that right?
Yeah, and biotech, yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. So, Prashant, please tell us about this deal and what's been happening.
You summed it all up really well. This is one of the largest preclinical exits in biotech globally, and it's really great that there's an Australian angle and a story to it. So Myrix was, as you said, founded in late 2018, early 2019 by Roberto Solari, who is at Ed Tate and Robin Carr. I should not exclude those of us. But Roberto is a venture partner with Brandon and has been, a key advisor to us going back many years. So we, along with Sourcenova, were early seed investors into a company that really at that stage was developing small molecule drugs, targeting an enzyme that that enables a post-translational modification called myristylation. I promise that's as much science as I'll get into. But I think the take home there is this process is really, is found to be upregulated in a lot of cancers. So I think the company then took the approach of targeting vulnerabilities in cancer by targeting this enzymatic process. Fast forward a few years, I think there was a recognition really that while it was a super exciting novel biology program, there was a potential risk of lower therapeutic index, and to try and address that, the company needed to come up with maybe a more clever way of ensuring that the drugs get to the tumor, but without avoiding any healthy tissue it might otherwise affect. So one approach to do that is through something called an antibody drug conjugate, where you use an antibody. Essentially, think of it as really targeted chemotherapy. So you rather than delivering the chemotherapy systemically all over the body, you deliver it very specifically to the tumor cells using an antibody. And so that's a really, really hot area. And a huge amount of credit goes to my colleague, Jonathan Tobin, who's is a bit of an expert in ADCs and really helped pivot the company from being a small molecule program into an ADC, and really was very active in helping make the company make that transition, and even so far as being named as an inventor on one of the patents, and then ultimately helping them to secure Series A investment, bringing in the management team and really being an active part of the board, along with some great investors like Abingworth, in British Patient Capital or British Business Bank, as it's now called, Nova Holdings and others. And one thing led to another, and the success is really great validation for following the science and really helping build a company that obviously has great science, but also has great management and investors and a team that can help build that company and then move it towards where it needs to get to the kind of exit that we do see.
That's huge. Congratulations to the full team and the fund. It's very exciting. So ADCs are clearly a hot topic. What does a deal like this mean for that category and future deals in the space?
ADCs are a hot area. There's been other quite large acquisitions as well. Pfizer acquiring Seagen, for example. Merck's acquired Belos Bio. So there is a history of transactions in ADCs, because fundamentally it comes out of the clinical data. When you look at the clinical data, ADCs have been really great at sometimes treating hard to treat cancers and then really having pronounced effects in some of these patients. So I think one of the challenges, however, with ADCs is that a lot of the ADCs use chemotherapy toxins, which can lead to resistance in patients. So there has always been a required or need for newer toxin payloads, and that's really the gap that Myricx was able to address. So there's a clear understanding of what the need or what the unmet need is at the moment, which is a requirement for new payloads that don't suffer from some of the toxicity and some of the resistance issues that other payload crosses might be encountering. And so I think this is an entire new class of drugs within the ADC space. So we're really excited to see this is still a preclinical deal. In due course, the company will go into patients and then endorse patients. So we're really excited to see how that all turns out.
And this exit is obviously a huge win for the venture ecosystem here, with some return of funds. What does it mean more broadly for Brandon and the Australian biotech ecosystem?
Look, the venture ecosystem in general is driven by return of capital. And I think this is a great exit for us, because we were founding investors and then we follow the company through the entirety of its journey. So, over $300 million worth of capital will be going back to our investors. We're at, superannuation funds, some of the largest superannuation funds like Hostplus, Hester, Aware Super, all investors in our funds. So I think return of capital hopefully will mean that, it's a real shot in the arm for the entire sector. We all need more capital to be able to be deployed, but in order for that to come to the venture funds to be deployable, we also need to be able to return capital to our investors. And I think on a couple of levels, this is a great outcome. Obviously, it's a great outcome from a monetary perspective, but it's also great that it validates the model of investing in Australia and gives hopefully our investors confidence in what we're able to do and really the kinds of quality companies that we're able to build and exit.
Awesome. And from a spin-out perspective, obviously this one was from the UK, and we've got lots of emerging spin-outs in Australia. We've seen a few exits here and there, but not quite the volume, obviously, we'd hoped for. Do you think we'll be able to replicate that in Australia in the short to medium term?
Look, I certainly hope so. And I think we have some very exciting companies in our portfolio, which are maybe a little bit earlier in the journey than Myricx in some regards, but they're all working towards exactly that. And I think, some great companies, some of whom are still developing, drugs for undruggable targets. So, instead of being the holy grail target in cancers, got programs looking at migraine, which has obviously, become a hot topic recently. So we've got a number of companies that are, you know, we've got programs in the in vivo CAR T space, which again is an area that's become very active recently. So, you know, there are great opportunities and great technologies and research that, you know, are, you know, born out of universities and medical research institutes here in Australia that we're investors in, but also, you know, other groups like Denmo and other investors are actually actively helping build. So, you know, I'm very positive about where we can take this going forward.
Awesome. Lots more to come, and stay tuned for many new exciting spin-outs through the pipeline, and hopefully some more funding for them too. Moving on to story two, AI in healthcare. Look, we've officially seen the AI uptake and the transition from scribe and admin work to more exciting and progressive fields like drug discovery with big tech, everything from Meta to Anthropic entering the race. And it's become very high stakes, evolving very quickly. Anthropic has officially launched Claude for Healthcare, its enterprise HIPAA-compliant healthcare platform, and is recruiting pretty heavily in the space, along with a few acquisitions. At the same time, we've seen AI drug discovery company Chai Discovery has become the new darling with a US 400 mil Series C, tipping its val over $3.8 billion in just 7 months from its last raise. So, Jackie, I'll start with you, given you have spent so much time in the AI space and continue to build awesome things there. What are we seeing happen at the moment, both locally and globally, in AI and healthcare?
Actually, a tricky one to answer in a succinct way, because I think the headliner is a lot. I think that increasingly people are trying to move towards generating impact and starting to be able to measure what are the actual outcomes, because there's a lot of almost like theoreticizing, like AI will unlock massive efficiencies in this part of healthcare, and there's heaps of studies which showcase, you know, different degrees of whether it's cost efficiency or time back to the individual frontline healthcare worker as it pertains to scribes. And so then companies are looking to move up or down the value chain to see where else can you unlock value, but also decommoditize your product, because very rapidly entire market segments essentially become commoditized, as is like kind of the trend within the scribing space. And big EMR players building their own scribe capabilities, so on and so forth. So I think it's kind of this, a bit of a land grab to say, like, how do we capture as much value and really like prove the use case? And is different kind of strategies. Some go top down, some go bottoms up to try and get user adoption and stickiness. So that's more broadly in the health tech sphere. If I think of more almost like from a clinical application of AI, so remove for a moment the question of pure like commercial value that the use of AI tools deliver. How might we then deliver better quality clinical outcomes? You can see here that big tech is also invested. They're investing a lot of resources into R&D capabilities for these new technologies. Yeah, looking at decision support, taking in the global health space where we work in, and how to enhance the capacity of frontline healthcare workers, build enabling systems. And so it brings this interesting dynamic of like, if big tech is able to invest so many resources and so almost like the fundamental R&D capabilities, when you're trying to innovate in this space, choosing where you invest your resources and capability, is it in like R&D or is it like applications of these technologies in a way that meaningfully fit into workflows, meaningfully improve clinical outcomes, so on and so forth. And so I think everyone's trying to like look at the ecosystem and be like, how do I deliver value tangibly and best allocate my resources in a way that isn't going to be cannibalized 2 months from now because big tech has snapped up an entire sector of the market.
And with that, where do you think people should be focused in order to work with or hedge against big tech?
Yeah, so like my point of view will be biased by what I do. Like transparently or frankly, like I don't spend as much time like in the know of what is happening in every single other market out there. So US, you like all of the more Western markets. So I'm slightly biased in my response, as I spend a lot of time in LMIC health and global health. But there we see that increasingly, you can have a tool and you can have a digital technology, but there's always like workflow, service delivery, implementation, change management that has to be a part of it. And we think about everything from like digital literacy, online, offline capability. And so I think the basic recipe for building products should still be, what is the problem I'm solving? What are the appropriate tools to solve this problem? Sometimes AI might be a component thereof, but the solution usually in digital health looks like some composition of digital technology, a change in workflow or service redesign, and then ultimately the behavioral change that's wrapped around it to actually make it sustainable and scalable. And so find a problem that is meaningful, that somebody cares about, that isn't homogenous. And this is kind of in juxtaposition to the kind of like, what's the biggest TAM, what's the biggest market size, and figure out how you can build a solution that is really deeply embedded in the workflows in a way that is unique to your company or your like skill set. Because I think that is less likely to be like, and let me call it cannibalized by big tech, because they're not going to be implementing digital tools into complex workflows in niche segments of healthcare.
It seems like with that, you need to just work with big tech, not against.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. 100%. I think like rising tide lifts all ships. So how do you take the mindset of like, how can we increase our own tempo of learning against what massive resources are being invested into?
Well, I'll pick on a couple of things. One is commoditizing, and I'll use a non-healthcare example. Microsoft launched its partnerships with OpenAI to great fanfare. And the idea was you could take the power of what ChatGPT does and incorporate it into your actual immediate work environment. You know, fast forward a little bit, and you know, now you also have Cowork also implemented within the Microsoft universe. And I think in part that's a reflection that these tools are all fantastic, amazing tools, but they are starting to almost converge on kind of similar levels of performance. You do get jumps. Obviously, the Fable and Mythos class of models are a step above what what Anthropic has been providing more broadly to its subscriber base. But by and large, you're seeing some convergence in performance. And the flip side of that is the energy cost and the cost of the tokens. And suddenly, you know, the cost of the tokens no longer commercially feasible for a lot of groups to actually pay for it. And where that has real implication for healthcare is a really complex purchasing environment. The people that use your service are not often the ones that are paying for it. And the ones that realize the benefit are not often are often the patients, but they might not necessarily be the ones paying for it either. That's a really complex dynamic. And then, you know, we're investors in a couple of AI-driven healthcare companies, and the things that we like about it are exactly some of the things that you mentioned, which is really deep understanding of the problem, a really clear understanding of the healthcare environment within which they operate, and then an application that really addresses those needs, not just for one part of the stakeholder chain, but for many parts of it.
Yeah. Like, I love the thread that's going down. A great analogy that I heard last week is we're in a world where all of the new models coming out, they're all high-speed trains, and we're trying to solve every problem with a high-speed train. But actually, different modes of transport are fit for purpose for different tasks and activities. And so when you think about the composition of your solution, you don't need a series of high-speed trains at every step of the process, because that impact so much, including the cost to serve. And for example, we work in markets where like willingness to pay is often quite a lot less than it might be in a Western market. So you really do have to contemplate what your underlying cost structure looks like to still deliver or yield the highest quality outcome that you're trying to solve for. And so I very much resonate with that framing.
Very quickly, the AI and drug discovery, what are the implications with the very large rounds that we're seeing Is there, do you have a strong view on how that's going to play out?
Well, a bit of a history lesson, but if you went back 5-6 years, there was another AI and drug discovery kind of wave. And you know, there's a tech bio wave. Everybody was going to come up with amazing algorithms that'll solve the AI, or that'll solve the problem of drug discovery using technology. These days it's called AI, might have been called machine learning then, might have been called something else before that. But I think specifically as it relates to drug discovery, I think really the proof of principle comes when you dose patients and show that you're able to treat disease. And there are many bottlenecks in that journey. Certainly generating new compounds and kind of things that Chai Discovery are doing is super exciting from a technology perspective, being able to just de novo say, I want a binder for this protein, and then being able to generate that is really cool. It's great technological advance. It's crazy, right? But ultimately, the proof of real value creation happens when you're able to make that in a lab, you know, tested in vitro systems, tested in you know, small animal models, large animal models, ultimately in patients, to really show that what you've generated, what your algorithm or your technology is able to generate valuable medicine. And I think that's a really long and expensive and arduous process. And you know, it's only now that the first wave of AI generated drug discovery companies are getting to that point. In silico medicine, probably being a good example of that. A lot of other companies have either pivoted or failed for many reasons, or maybe have, let's say, changed the scope of their work. So, short answer, I think it's a really nuanced subject, and I'm always, you know, loath to get carried away one way or the other. I think there are layers to this problem, and certainly groups like Chai are doing a great job in solving some of these really deep questions. Value realization was still quite a long way along.
So stay tuned is the answer. That's got potential, but yet to be seen as how it pays.
Yet to be proven, I'd say. And I, you know, I wish them well. I do hope somebody proves it. And in the while, the company's working in similar spaces, so it's clearly an idea that a lot of people want to try and crack. And if somebody does, that'll be great.
Just to add to that, on that same kind of thread of still to be proven, when we think of, for example, decision support enabled by AI, there was a paper released recently with Penda Hill, where they put decision support into the hands of primary care centers and had clinicians that were nudged by this, and essentially TLDR, the outcomes were that when they measured kind of clinical outcomes after X period of time for these patients, there was no harm that was yielded and there was no tangible benefit, but it was a baseline that was measured. So there are efficiencies in the consultation that are unlocked. But when we look at clinical outcomes of using decision support at the point of care, at this point in time, using pure LLM-based decision support tools in the way that specific configuration and patient clinician composition and the context, there's so much that matters. You know, it was a really high quality of care that was being delivered, but the baseline was established. And still, so what was it? Still TBD? Like, that, I think that's very much what we're seeing.
Early days. Let's shift gears a little. Recently in the policy landscape, we've seen the government come and introduce a few big reformed or potential reforms to the R&D tax incentives set to come into effect from July 2028. It's caused much uproar in the broader ecosystem, with all the industry bodies banding together and a lot of strong views. Prashanth, can you perhaps give us a bit of a rundown on the latest happenings in this space?
Yeah. So firstly, for those who are not aware, Australia is really, really widely regarded as an excellent place to run clinical studies, in part due to the really high quality of clinical care, the really great kind of research, research culture within the Australian clinical landscape. And as a result, it has become one of the go-to countries for you know, pharmaceutical companies and biotechs to come and run clinical studies, and most importantly, the data that is generated in Australia can then be used for as a part of regulatory submissions in the US and in Europe, etc. The other element to that is the R&D tax incentive, which essentially provides a 43.5% rebate. And there are some nuances to that, but broadly or roughly, it's in that ballpark, or provides a rebate back to the company. So it provides some, you know, the rebate is really valuable for early stage biotech and pharma companies, because the costs of developing drugs really are in the hundreds of millions. Now, the proposed changes, I think it's fundamentally coming from a good place, but one of the, I suppose, unintended consequences is that there's been a proposal to put in a 10-year time cap on the period during which companies are able to claim R&D tax rebates on their research expenditure. And that really has massive ramifications for the biotech, medtech, deep tech industries. So speaking for biotech, like, these are some numbers. Some of your viewers may be aware of it, but you know, the current kind of success rate for a drug once it enters into a trial to actually get approved is about 7%. So in other words, 93% of all drugs going into clinical trials failed. And the time it takes to get from discovery all the way through approval is, it's in the 10 to 20 year range. So if you have a time cap at 10 years, which is usually when companies are now starting to really scale up their clinical trial activity, which is probably the most expensive part of the development process, you're really handicapping that industry. And so that has been, I guess, one of the unintended consequences of some of the changes that the government has proposed. And it's certainly something that the industry has banded around, saying this can be really damaging to the sector.
And what this could potentially mean is that we lose a whole lot of this early stage pipeline being cut off, a lot of the potential, I guess, people coming here for clinical trials too, as well as setting up companies, right? And obviously the government has spoken to how much they want more companies set up here, more talent retention here, more capability, manufacturing, development and whatnot. But with these changes, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great summary. So I think the real risk is that companies, as they grow more mature and are getting to the stage where they need to raise capital, will inevitably consider moving overseas, where it might be easier to recruit patients, where there might be more capital available, easier to execute on some of these trials relative to Australia. So we're actually giving away one of our great advantages, which I think, using a football World Cup analogy, is a bit of an own goal, right? And then so that's certainly not something we want to see. I think there is a consultation process ongoing, and then industry peak bodies like Oz Biotech and others, and including our own Brandon Capital, we've all put in submissions just to really try and help the government understand that the damages can be quite significant. I referenced having just come back from bio. You know, a few years ago, you would have to go and tell people about the R&D tax rebates and the clinical and the quality of clinical trials in Australia. That is no longer the case. The global industry knows about it now. Everybody is completely aware of what a great place this is to do clinical trials. And I think there's a real risk that we're squandering some of that hard-built advantage and reputation to this. So I really hope that there will be some reversal to some of these proposed changes.
For anyone listening, please reconsider your life choices. We did it on CGT, and our entire industry would really benefit from an extension to that 10-year cap, potentially with more happening here, more capital flowing back, as well as the activity in China. It's really positioned us with a potential great advantage, and I think we can't afford to squander that now.
You touched on China. That's another country with an increasingly, where companies from the US and Europe are often looking now at China as another alternative to running clinical trials. So there is a lot more competition now, and we can't afford to give away some of the advantages that we've built over many years. So I think removing a time cap on this will be really meaningful. And as I said, the biotech industry in Australia is really well regarded globally. were relatively small in terms of population, but if you look at the kind of companies that come out of Australia, just globally, there's a recognition that this is a really strong ecosystem. And I think we run the risk of damaging an ecosystem that actually employs hundreds of thousands of people, both in actual product development and biotech startups and pharma companies, but also in the entirety of the clinical trial and CRO sector. So yeah, as I said, I really hope we can turn around some of these changes and go back to a non-automated position.
Awesome. Fingers crossed. So we don't love the R&D tax incentive changes. Thumbs down. He can't bring himself to do it. Moving on. Fresh news this week. It will be a few weeks potentially when this goes out. But Brisbane and Sydney-based Advancell has just announced an oversubscribed and upsized US$315 million Series D, which is more than 450 Aussie, which is one of the largest private biotech funding rounds in Australian history, I believe. There's also been a whole heap of new investors jumping in, and the funds are going towards expansion into phase three trials and setting up a solid manufacturing capacity in Boston. Prashanth, can you tell us a little bit about why this is such an exciting company and a big deal?
I'll take you back a few minutes. We were talking about antibody blood conjugates, the idea of taking really targeted chemotherapy. Advancell is a radiopharmaceutical company, so you can apply the same principle, except you can swap out the antibodies for a peptide, and rather than a chemotherapy, you're delivering targeted radiation. So that's the concept in a nutshell. There are obviously nuances to this, and there are many radioisotopes, as they call. They're the actual radioactive metals, typically, that are used to deliver the radiation. And like with ADCs, you know, when you know the impact it had on patients is profound, particularly in prostate cancer, where you know you see the before and after images of patients. They do a PET scan and they light up all over the bodies, so showing you know they have metastatic cancers, often not responding to any treatments. They undergo a period of radiopharmaceutical treatment, and then we scan them again, and they clear up cancer. So the impact is profound, and in the case of radiopharmaceuticals, you can image it. So it's quite striking. Advancell is developing a particular isotope called Lead-212, which, without going into too many details, has many of the ideal characteristics you would want to see from a radioisotope, but one challenge, which is that manufacturing it is not really that easy to do. And radioisotopes have something called a half-life. Lead's half-life is 10.6 hours. So what that means is really you need to be able to manufacture the product and get it into the arms of patients in a time frame that will enable sufficient radiation dosage to be delivered. That's a logistical challenge. So there's two challenges. One, you've got the logistics, so you need to be, and two, you've got the ability to actually manufacture the lead in a way that is pure and can be used for as a drug substance. Advancell's, Andrew Adamovich and Simon Puttick, two of the co-founders from Sydney and Brisbane, came up with this idea and then built a generator that enables Advancell to do this. It's a proprietary generator technology that addresses some of those manufacturing and logistical challenges. Brannan Capital and a couple of the other Australian VCs, including 10 Mile, participated in the Series C financing round. And since then, the company's just only gone from strength to strength. Showed some early data at ESMO last year, again showing that in an initial patient clinical study, they had about 7 patients that were evaluable under RECIST criteria, which is the criteria that you're basically evaluating whether or not the treatment has an effect. And in the 7 patients that were evaluable in those criteria, all of them showed a complete response. So that was a great outcome for the company. And since then, we've brought in a new management team. Relocated the headquarters to Boston. The company is building a whole new manufacturing facility in the Boston area, and now have raised the $315 million Series D round, which I think, Emily, as you said, is probably the largest private biotech investment bound in Australia. So huge kudos to the founders, but also the management team for having pulled us off. And yeah, really excited to see how the program continues to progress through the clinic.
No easy feat, and great to see an Australian company leading the way in this category. And I think really speaks to the conviction in the potential of the management team, the science, the approach, which is awesome to see Australia as a emerging leader on the world stage in this category. So big congrats to our shared portfolio company, AdvanCell.
Albert, actually, since we were talking about clinical studies, it's probably worth mentioning that Australia, again, is seen as a world leader in radiopharmaceuticals, in part because there is such a strong track record in amongst the clinical community in Australia for having run a lot of clinical studies. So for a country of our size, obviously there's AdvanCell, but there are some really well-regarded companies that are listed, like Helix and Clarity, are also doing great work in this space. So I think there is AdvanCell's an outstanding story. We're super excited about the company. But I also do want to, you know, give my kudos to many of the clinicians who have helped, you know, develop, including AdvanCell's own technologies as advisors, as members of scientific advisory boards and clinical advisory boards. So thought it's worth saying.
Completely. It takes a village and really speaks to the wealth of talent that we've got here in Australia, building these categories that over time compound to make these opportunities even possible. So yay, go on.
I think there's also like a really great, whether you intended the sequencing of these new snippets to tell the story, that it's like, would these success stories be around if we didn't have such strong incentives and enabling factors such as R&D tax incentive programs? So we wouldn't be talking about the kind of news.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And things like R&D tax, I mean, Australia is a relatively small venture investment market compared to the US. So, you know, the R&D tax, some of the non-dilutive funding schemes, these are all, you know, really critical to, especially at the early stage for a lot of companies to be able to get started and get to the point where they're able to attract real investment capital.
That really is such a great point and speaks to, we're starting to see some of these success stories really come through, get to later stages, even a few exits. And we've always had such wonderful science, but perhaps struggle to commercialize it or see the successful commercial returns come back to Australia, as opposed to some overseas countries. The US has a much larger scale, obviously. And so hopefully we can continue to build that pipeline and not jeopardize that with any extreme changes to the great environment and, I guess, fertile grounds we've produced. Here in Australia, Melbourne-founded Everlab has recently announced an Aussie $65 million Series A led by Airtree and Left Lane Capital, really showing the conviction now in venture as well behind these preventative health companies, which I think previously may have been a bit shrouded in skepticism, which is understandable. But we've also seen this backed up by endless overseas raises, including the US $700 million raise of Neko Health, Daniel X startup. Wait, is that true? Before even launching in the US? There we go. Crazy times. Nonetheless, we're seeing the longevity trend take full flight. So I'll throw it to you, Jack. Are we witnessing the future of primary care and healthcare? Or what's your take on this trend?
So I have a conflicted view within myself, and I'll just like state that up front. So as someone who's personally really passionate about preventative health and longevity, and I subscribe to and practice a lot of the like maybe sauna and endurance events, and I dose up creatine and haven't had my full body scan, but like I personally am a fan of this, and I see the benefits to particularly well-functioning healthcare systems where it feels like we're trying to address perhaps like the pre-chronic disease burden that is still in almost like a nascent sleeping phase, captured earlier. It's a great shift when we think about like health system dynamics. So plus, really positive, and I'm a big fan. And similar to you, like I've known the guys at Everlab, and it's super exciting and it's great to see that investment come into Australia. So from almost like a venture commercial opportunity and making healthcare better for health systems that maybe kind of work already, amazing. But then when I put my public health hat on, which is obviously biased by the work that I'm in every single day, where we still see like maternal morbidity as something that's still a very tangible problem and people dying from really simple preventable diseases and basic care, like I can't help but wonder if we take a step back more broadly and look at all of the investment that is going into the likes of longevity, the rationale may make sense from a venture point of view in terms of what's the ROI and the potential to return the fund. But what is the public health impact that these may have as they scale? Because we are increasing capacity and access to healthcare for the upper echelons of society that have the willingness to pay and the ability to pay and are in that like access bracket. And so in theory, there is a trickle-down effect where ultimately better healthcare should, in theory, trickle down to better healthcare for lower socioeconomic pockets of the world. But I have like a little bit of skepticism, like, will we actually see that manifest? Because we're still solving problems that arguably should not be here, like decades on, in many regions that are very fragile in the world, low to middle income countries, so on and so forth. So I'm both excited and elated. And then from a public health point of view, because you can't deny that private companies that build in healthcare have a systemic public health impact. So what does that then mean for broader?
Yeah, it's I feel you. It's an interesting tug of war inside my brain where it's like, great, better healthcare, preventative health, finally not relying on people to just fix things when they're broken and address it sooner. And I'd like to believe that it will eventually trickle down, particularly as it becomes more easy to scale and obviously costs come down and whatnot. But the reality is we're also seeing that divide get bigger. And if we're not addressing the commercial systems that would enable this healthcare to address the people who are in a completely different situation in third world countries, then it's a bit challenging.
Yeah, nuances is really critical. And your question was, will this address primary healthcare? And I'm not sure how much it'll address primary healthcare as opposed to maybe adding another layer of preventative healthcare on top of primary. I mean, if you have a cold, you're going to go and see a GP anyway, right? You're not just because you've gone and, you know, spent time in a sauna, maybe sauna can help. So that is probably not the goodest. Yeah, But you get my point. Just because you lift weights doesn't mean you're not going to fall sick. You will. And a lot of the primary healthcare will come in at that stage. I feel like this will enable us not so much to take away the burden from primary healthcare, but maybe help us all live longer and live better. And that in and of itself is a noble goal. But I do also completely see what you're talking about, you know, the access to such treatments in facilities is invariably, because of the business model, be restricted to those that can afford it and not the lower middle income countries, for example, where if one were to just really step back and take a public health view and say, what can we do to increase, let's say, life expectancy? These are the kinds of things that will help people that are already going to live longer, live better, as opposed to addressing, you know, massive discrepancies in life expectancy, let's say in lower middle income countries, which often less than 70, whereas most of the Western world countries were enjoying, you know, 85 years of life these days.
But I think what I obviously don't have a look under the hood of is I'm sure that many longevity companies are looking to optimize their underlying cost structure and think about diversifying price point and extending the frontier of preventative health into like a broader category of patients. So like one, there's acknowledgement of that, in that like likely that is happening, though I don't have the insight or the look under the hood to see that innovation that's happening. And then I guess there's also like a likely rationale of increased longevity of a class of society probably also means like greater economic contributions by those people in whatever they're doing. So yeah.
different effects on the economic model, the primary care model. And I think the question I have is, I suppose, how will this change even primary care? Because obviously we will all still need doctors, but we're seeing inherently with the fast change of the industry, the role of primary care is changing. And as consumer appetite is driving this uptake in these scans and these concierge medicine services and coaches, how will general practice in Australia or primary care change? Will we be shifting to more preventative-led services, or is it just the empowered patient who will be coming to doctors with different things? And I think the impacts and flow-on effects of that, we're so early in figuring that out. It's not going away. Consumers are voting with their dollars. Yeah. It's a huge industry projected. It's like 4 times bigger than the fashion industry, I believe, already in terms of the funding flowing in and consumer purchase power.
Yeah. And I think on this, it is really interesting because I find myself doing that when I go to a GP. So I've started to try to stop self-diagnosing and treating myself and actually get somebody else to help take that cognitive load. And I myself will come in with like a really curated list of these are all of my like biomarkers that I've tracked over time, not in like in my own way. And I want help in optimizing this part of my life or that part of my life or managing these specific things. And it then creates the relationship where somebody is more of like a partner in helping you work towards healthcare outcomes. And that will, I see, be the natural flow on and impact in what we're already seeing in the longevity space. And I think that's how primary care and preventative care will increasingly start to bleed into one another.
The empowered patient moving much more as a partner versus the paternalistic historical style of medicine.
I actually had a friend who went into a GP consult and she had put all her health information into Claude, and she literally had Claude speak to her GP. "Hi, Dr. So-and-so. I'm here to tell you a little bit more about insert friend's name concerns." And the GP was a bit like, "Oh, I've never done this before, but I can work with it. You know, like let's see how we go."
I can fully see a world where that becomes much more the norm, though, because even the other day, my mum has been suffering from sudden onset high blood pressure, like extremely high, historically very low, and trying to, like, you know, have her advocate for herself in ways that the doctor would understand was really hard. So I had to default to, here is a ChatGPT readout for you to say exactly what the clinical summary is and like why this is more of a concern. And I think as these technologies move forward, we'll see more and more of that too.
But what would be nice is if we are approaching a scenario where, you know, you read about the NHS, you even read about some of the things that are happening in Australia, public health systems are hitting capacity. So if preventative systems like this were able to take some of the burden off for public health systems, I think that would be a really ideal outcome out of all of the work.
Yeah, I think what you're speaking to is starting to measure the health economic outcomes of earlier intervention, management and treatment, which is essentially if you're doing extended biomarker scans and screening, as well as the kind of array of services that are offered, ideally then the hypothesis or the causal chain would be in the long term that has a health economic impact. And so I think that will be really interesting to track over time.
Completely. And I think to your point, as we see healthcare systems around the world crumble, there needs to be different solutions. And this offers an interesting viable option. That's it for the news for today. Let's finish with the What the Health rapid fire. So quick questions. First thing that comes to mind, don't overthink it. No dumb answers here. Biggest surprise for each of you this fortnight?
I have one, but it's not directly related to health. So a lot of LLM chat, self-assessment learning, health tools that are being deployed in the markets in which we operate use WhatsApp as the core interface to deliver health education to patients and chat with. So WhatsApp is the key interface, not apps, not whatever. And Meta introduced a new pricing model that has just killed a whole bunch of self-care capabilities. Where previously it would be like, oh, you'd be priced for the first message and then every interaction thereafter was like at a reduced cost. And so suddenly the underlying business models for a lot of consumer-facing tools are being put under a quite low jeopardy. And I'm like, wow.
Insane. That is a big surprise.
That's going to be my surprise. I had not heard of that. So I'm just going to piggyback off you. because it is true, right? WhatsApp has become such a key part of communication and increasingly being pulled into communications, even with apps and things like that, not just you texting your friends. So I did not realize the implications or indeed some of the changes coming to the pricing model there and its implication.
Wild. Okay. Changing tact a little. Favorite emoji, Prashant?
Oh, wow. The one with the laughing, crying laughing thing. I realize that's probably the one I use the most. Or the skull that I think is the alternative. Depending on what age group of people I'm messaging.
Appropriate emoji usage.
Yeah.
Mine's a green heart.
Oh, yes. Excellent.
You've seen choice. It.
I've got a purple heart, so I know the vibes. Company to watch.
So again, I'll be global health centric. Company called Neura. I was dreaming about them yesterday. And they're focusing on empowering health caregivers. So not patients, not clinicians. The caregiver, the family member, the grand, the daughter, the cousin, the whatever, twice removed. And I thought that was just a really interesting customer segment to go after.
Nice. Very interesting approach.
And I'd be a terrible VC if I didn't pick a few from our portfolio. But given our earlier conversation, I think, you know, some of our companies like MicRx, Curis Biologics, Soros is another company that we've recently founded they're all working on really interesting, really challenging healthcare problems. We're excited about all of them. And I've probably forgotten a few. Luminos AI is another company that I mentioned doing building an AI model, an AI layer for delivery of radiation oncology treatments. So yeah, very excited about some of those companies. And apologies to all the other companies that I'd got to mention.
We love them all, but it's too much exciting things happening to watch. What's your favorite resource, whether it's health or otherwise? Anything jump to mind? Podcast, okay. Newsletter, book?
I'll give you a funny one because I saw these questions and I thought, oh, now ask ChatGPT because it's basically my second memory. What's my favorite resource? And this is going to sound really bad, but it's at S1 Documents. So apparently that's what I read most of. So the Securities Exchange Commission in the US and the FDA documents. Apparently that's where I spent most of my time reading.
Maybe I should spend more time there. Oh.
Like my husband, I always find him reading fine print of like tax law. What an interesting human. I think mine would be Lenny's podcast and newsletter. Does a lot of like product, but also interviews like phenomenal product leaders working in AI. And he really critically interrogates even, I think, some of the pressure that we're feeling. Like everyone feels like they're not keeping up with how quickly AI is being used, or are you using it enough in your workflows? And is it changing my world in a ground-breaking way? And if it isn't, I'm too slow. And then he also released a really interesting piece recently that was like saying, in a world where the way we work is fundamentally so different because of the use of LLM in day-to-day workflows, how do you think about the emotional skills or your inner world and how you navigate the ambiguity of the workplace within that?
Yeah.
And I loved it. Like, I would recommend hyperlinking it into whatever you share next.
You definitely will. We'll put it in the show notes.
I'm a big fan of like how your inner world presents in the work that you do every day. And Lenny is a no BS communicator thereof.
We love. All right, on that note, we might wrap it up since we've been yapping for far too long in the best possible way. Jackie, Prashant, thank you so much for joining us for our inaugural episode of the What the Health Wrap. Hopefully we've helped you feel a little bit more informed, understand what's happening in the world of health recently. If you liked this, please like, subscribe, share. We are new. Give us feedback. And if there is anything you want to see or hear about next time, drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. That's all for today. See you next time.